This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I've seen horrors. Horrors that you've seen. But you have no right to call me a murderer. You have a right to kill me. You have a right to do that. But you have no right to judge me.
That's Marlon Brando as Kurtz in Apocalypse Now. Two new books about Brando have just been published, one by Brando himself, the other a 1,000-page biography written by my guest Peter Manso. Manso writes, Brando affected generations of filmgoers with his extraordinary presence in A Streetcar Named Desire, The Wild One, On the Waterfront, and The Godfather. He, more than anyone, rocked the culture with his T-shirts, tight jeans, leather jacket, and tough guy sensibility. But, Manso continues, that myth has been shattered, replaced by Brando's image as an overweight, confused, and weary man, burdened by guilt and self-reproach. Brando's breakthrough role was as Stanley in the stage and screen productions of A Streetcar Named Desire. But Manso says even before that, Brando gave an exceptional performance in a show that ran only 10 days called Truckline Cafe, directed by Harold Clurman. I asked Manso if Brando's mumbling was controversial in his early stage career.
Marlon is first and foremost a manipulator. Interpersonally, he's a manipulator. You can say all actors are manipulators. But Marlon's mumbling is a form of manipulation. Quite often, he does not mumble. And the mumbling was not a problem during Streetcar. It was a problem on Truckline Cafe during rehearsals, and Clurman did this marvelous thing, which is in the book, where this was during the rehearsal period, he had Marlon climb up and down a rope and scream at the top of his lungs some of his lines just to free him up. And it was a big breakthrough. But the mumbling is a form of manipulation. It's a shtick with Marlon.
So when Brando was starring opposite Jessica Tandy, who was playing
right.
Blanche in the stage production of Streetcar, they must have had very different approaches to acting.
Absolutely. I spent 2 days with Jessie Tandy, and her response, or how she spoke about responding to Marlon, was very interesting. She was in awe of his energy, the rawness, the dangerousness, the explosiveness of his talent. On the other hand, she made a linkage between that talent and a kind of root, or what she saw as a kind of root laziness in Marlon's character, a point which was also made in my talks with Kazan and others. They did not get along. Marlon singled Jesse out. The cast, it was a marvelous situation because the cast became a real family. But Jesse, nonetheless, was singled out by Marlon as his target. He designated her the older authority figure. And he did some really rotten things to her while on stage. About halfway through the run, when the boredom was setting in heavy, one night, Jesse recalled being on stage and at the most inappropriate moment, realizing that the audience was laughing. And she looked at Marlon, who was, I think, to her left, and there he was upstage of her, and he had inserted a cigarette into his nostril. He would paw at himself. He would scratch his crotch just to break her lines. And it got so bad that she told me straight out, I had a nervous breakdown halfway through that run, and I went to my psychiatrist and told him, I don't know what I'm doing. I've been on the stage for 20 years, but I don't know what I'm doing in the face of this kid's talent and also this kid's manipulation of me, abuse of me.
What do you think was changed by Brando's performances on stage and screen in Streetcar?
Oh, he virtually changed American acting. There is not a young actor in Hollywood today who wouldn't pay $25 just to watch Brando cross the street. I mean, prior to Streetcar, acting in this country, Bing Crosby, William, Powell, leading men was basically, the industry's touchstone to acting, that or English costume acting. With Brando, put aside the word method, which I think it's vastly overused, Brando brought a kind of naturalism to acting, which was akin almost to what Whitman did with poetic language. He naturalized it. acting was no longer a formalistic thing. It was now a psychoanalytic, indeed sexual vehicle. And it just stood everyone on their head. No one had ever seen anything like this. And it was all the more impressive because it was coming out of this kid who was relatively unschooled, who was not New York, who was not Jewish, who had not, you know, been brought up with New York sophistication. He was an Auslander. This is a kid from the Midwest. People couldn't believe it.
Was it about the time of Streetcar that Brando started seeing a psychiatrist?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, he had what a number of people, his sister, Ilya Kazan, any number of his friends speak of as a breakdown. He had several breakdowns in New York during this period, which took the form of anxiety attacks, I mean, such that he would be paralyzed. He would run through the streets of New York at 2 o'clock in the morning to run off his fear. Kazan led him to the analyst whom Kazan and his wife were then seeing. The analyst's name was Béla Mittelmann. He was a Hungarian analyst of the Sándor Rado school, if that has any relevance. He was basically a no-goodnik who had a lot of celebrity clients, and he sanctioned, by and large, what Marlon wanted. So you can call it supportive therapy, but it got so crazy at one point that Marlon brought him in to break up Marlon's engagement to Movita, the woman whom he subsequently married. I mean, Mittelmann was wrapped around Brando's finger. Brando stayed with him until the time of Mittelmann's death in 59, and then, of course, continued analysis with a succession of people, such that it's fair to say that Marlon has more or less been in continuous analysis throughout his adult life.
Let's move up to the making of On the Waterfront. You say that this period of Brando's life gives new meaning to the Freudian chestnut, art is a correction of neurosis.
Well, Marlon comes up as a child in a very unhappy situation. Both his parents are alcoholics, though I must note his mother dried out in 1946 and became a mainstay of the alcoholism movement. The notion that art serves as a correction to Marlon's neurosis takes on poignancy only when you see what happens when Marlon abandons art. To wit, when he's working with Kazan, and we're talking now not only the stage production of Streetcar, but the film of Streetcar, Viva Zapata, and of course Waterfront, or when he's working with Mankiewicz, Julius Caesar. When Marlon pulled away from working with these people, and bear in mind, he gets the Oscar, his first Oscar, for On the Waterfront in 55. Marlon, the sensitive, Marlon the vulnerable, suddenly comes into an enormous amount of power within the industry. It's at this point, when he's designated one of the top box office drawers, that Marlon ceases to work with Kazan. Now, that was complicated by the fact that Kazan testified before HUAC, which Marlon saw as a betrayal, but he did one more film with Joe Mankiewicz, Guys and Dolls, which was, you know, basically a dumb film, but a guaranteed moneymaker. After that, Marlon fundamentally sells out to Hollywood. He does things like Tea House of the August Moon. Junk.
My guest is Peter Manso, the author of a new biography of Marlon Brando. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with Peter Manso about his new biography of Marlon Brando. Let's move up to his film, The Godfather, a fine performance in an extraordinary film that I think gave people the opportunity to see him in a new light again. He thought he was going to be too washed up for the role. He was advising the people who wanted him that the studio would never let him.
Well, Mario Puzo told me that when he was writing the book, he was thinking of Marlon. Mm-hmm. Marlon was the model. And that at one point when the film was about to happen, or, you know, was becoming a reality, Puzo called Marlon, and Marlon, you know, said, look, thank you very much, but I'm all washed up. I would like to say that I think the film is better as a film than Marlon's performance is good as a performance.
Why do you say that?
Well, again, you know, Brando's mesmerizing in the film. I agree with that. But, you know, it's basically a character role. It is not a well-rounded role. It is not a full role. There was a great deal of controversy at the time that it was Marlon who had been nominated for the Best Actor Oscar, and Al Pacino, who had been nominated for the Best Supporting Oscar, when in fact Pacino has twice as many lines, if you just count them in the script, as Brando. And we can't forget, look, art always follows money. This is an old saw, and I dare say that some of the luster that accrues to Marlon's performance, the reputation of his performance, has inevitably a lot to do with just how much money the film made, how successful it was. And then, too, it was Marlon's big comeback, because during the 60s, not only did Marlon think he was washed up, most people did. As you probably know, Marlon had to actually audition. He had to do an audition to get the part of Don Corleone.
I find it really interesting hearing you talk about Brando, because on the one hand, you seem in awe of his talent in some movies. On the other hand, you speak with him the way somebody might speak about a brother with whom they've been very close, but there's some really fundamental rift that happened between them, and there's just a kind of air of like dislike and condescension when you speak about Brando, too. But as if you're like very intimate with him. But
yes.
But you want to tell people, it sounds like you're trying to tell people, listen, this guy's really talented, but be careful of him. Trust
yes.
me, but be careful of him.
Yes. Now, what I will tell you, and I regard myself in my role as biographer in large part as, you know, the medium and not the message itself. I mean, I interviewed maybe 1,000 people for this book, and it took me 2.5-3 years to wake up to what people, including his daughter, for example, mean when they speak of Marlon as Svengali in a personal relationship, as the true-life godfather in a personal relationship, i.e. Marlon's manipulativeness. It took me 3 years to begin to get a handle on that. And one of the ways I finally came to accept it against my strongest reservations, because, again, for me and many people of my era, my ilk, Brando was our guy. He's the guy who took the point. But the way I came to grips with it was in a fairly simple-minded way, to see it in the context of Marlon's upbringing and the kind of chaos that he was forced to grow up with, and finally to recognize it as, you know, Marlon's attempt to keep chaos at bay, because he's a man continually threatened by chaos. Now, condescension, no, I have to reject that. If you say that I sometimes sound angry at Marlon, yes, that's absolutely true.
Do you have to be careful as a biographer to make sure that you're angry with Brando because he didn't cooperate with you on the book?
No, he has a book that's competing
with your book. Do you have to be careful that that doesn't color your feelings about him as a performer or as a man?
What's your response if I say that I would say the same things to myself as a daily mantra for 8 years, which is true?
What do you mean? I don't understand.
You know, you cannot judge Marlon. You cannot, I mean, in the text, in the writing of this book, you must let the story, you must let other voices speak for themselves. Your job is to get the material, to organize the material in an intelligent, resonant way, but you don't judge and you don't psychoanalyze.
You're judging during the interview.
You mean now, after the fact?
Yeah.
Yes, I am, but I would ask you to consider the judgment here. Ultimately has nothing to do with Marlon's book, Marlon's attempt to, you know, take a hedge against my book. That's not what's at issue here, ultimately. The anger you may hear, coupled as it is with awe and respect and, you know, whatever, is the same kind of anger that I have at waste. Because finally, in the final analysis, what is so sad about this story is the waste that is involved. And the same pattern presents itself, say, in Marlon's political activities.
If you were making a movie now, would you give Brando a role in it if there was a role suitable for him?
I think, first off, I'm not a movie maker, but of course, I mean, you know, my mind would immediately go to Marlon. I mean, I've had fantasies in the course of writing this book of maybe you should, Peter, try and write a screenplay for Marlon. I mean, it's one of those insane, you know, middle-of-the-night thoughts that biographers have when they're locked into a long-term project.
Do you hope one day to meet Brando?
Oh, I fantasized about that, too. You know, it's kind of crazy in real-life terms to spend almost 8 years of your life writing a book about someone without having the thought, gee, you know, we ought to break bread. But I think he's so filled with pus and venom when it comes to the subject of Peter Manzo that not a whole lot would be accomplished.
Peter Manzo is the author of Brando, the biography. This is Fresh Air.